Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's June 3, 2014, and this is episode 424. Every so often in history, someone writes a book that changes everything. A book so profound that everyone that wants to live not only a creative life, but a richer, fuller life will read. Well, my friend David Duchemin has just done that. Again. His earlier best-selling books changed things. David has given photographers and artists a vocabulary that I feel was missing in modern photography. Now he's given us permission and the courage to live the creative life that many of us long to live, and I even believe a means to identify what that life might be to you in a beautiful anarchy when the life creative becomes the life created. For links, visit mbp.ac/424. For now, though, I know you're going to enjoy this conversation with David Duchemin. Okay, so I'm delighted to be sitting here this fine morning in Tokyo with my friend David Duchemin, who's over in Vancouver, and we're going to be talking about David's new book, and it's probably another game changer. So congratulations on A Beautiful Anarchy, David, and welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Martin. It's good to be back.
So, A Beautiful Anarchy, you sent me a preview copy that I read last week, and I'm blown away. I mean, it's times like this. I'm always proud to be able to say that we're friends, but, you know, it's one of these times that I feel like in awe of what you do. It's just incredible. You've done it again. I think you've. I know that you don't like it when I blow smoke up your ass like this. So I'm not going to do that very much. But yeah, I think when I first read Within the Frame, I felt as though you'd changed photography literature and the just creative life sort of based literature. But A Beautiful Anarchy, your latest book that's just come out, has done that again in a very, very beautiful and really profound way. So we're going to talk about that today. Let's just start, you know, tell us in an elevator speech of what Beautiful Anarchy is.
Yeah, thanks. I think the subtitle covers it fairly well. The subtitle is When the Life Creative Becomes the Life Created. And a number of things kind of came to bear in my own life that made me want to write this, even just regardless of making it into a book, but just the need to set this stuff on paper. Mm. But it all started with the accident that I had in Italy 3 years ago, and I had already been sort of thinking about the brevity of life and the importance of being very intentional about life, and then the accident kind of, you know, took everything up to 11. The way that I have taught photography has always been fairly consistent, but I think, it kind of went up a notch after this accident, and I began to become, you know, I've talked about vision a lot, and people sometimes get a little confused. What does vision mean? Because really it's a metaphor. And lately I've kind of ditched the metaphor, although I still think it's really useful, but I talk more about intent or intention. Yeah. What do you want out of this photograph? And so I started writing A Beautiful Anarchy. The name came from a blog post I did when I was talking about creativity and how in art there are no rules. Even the idea of, and ultimately I know it's semantic, but even the idea of you got to know the rules before you can break them, I would rather embrace a paradigm that says really truly in this realm of human experience and endeavor that there aren't rules. There are principles, and I think principles are helpful, but the rules are, I think, I don't know, I've just never really got along well with the rules. So, you know, when someone talks about the rule of thirds, I would rather talk about why the so-called rule of thirds works and then allow that principle to guide whether we use it or whether we don't, rather than just slavishly adhering to something. And so this is all kind of the background for starting to write the book. And I wanted to write a book about creativity for photographers, because you can read 100 books about photography and one of them will talk about the creative process, but mostly it's technical. And yet the hardest work of photographers is done in the creative sphere. It's done with, yes, I hope growing mastery of our craft, but it's also done from the heart and from the mind, and that's where the creativity happens. And so the more I started writing this book, and people have always said, you know, David, you're not just writing about photography, you're writing about life. As this book kind of evolved, as the creative process is, you know, is wont to do, the thing became something else. And I realized I was writing about life and the way that we create our photographs and that we engage in the creative process, whether we're photographers or potters or writers, is the same way in which we engage in creating the life that we want. And it's often been said, you know, photography is about life. It's not the other way around. And I very much agree with that. And I think, so looking at the gift that photography gives me in terms of recognizing moments and the brevity of time and all of that sort of kind of, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, this poet warrior artsy fartsy stuff, it's foundational. It's not a luxury that, well, I'll think about that later. No, you learn your craft on an ongoing basis as much as it interests you or as much as you feel you need to, but that creative stuff, that how do, you know, people say, where do your ideas come from? Well, that's kind of part of this book. It's also an urge to act. Creativity is not just good ideas. It's shipping. It's launching whatever that product is, that project. And the book talks about time and it talks about money. It talks about all kinds of aspects that inform and are affected by the creative life. So that is a very long rambling answer.
Yeah, question. I think we're at about floor 800 at the moment, but that's fine. I've been obviously trying to come up with various ways to tell people how great A Beautiful Anarchy is, and I mean I'm not as wordy a person as in, you know, in a good way as you are. You know, in that I don't
very
do
few people are.
Well, I don't, I mean, like you say, I mean the poet warrior, you know, example that you use, it's something that not a lot of people can do. And I think that is partly, you're able to do that in such a good way because of the life that you're living and your background and everything. And this is why, you know, the books that you've written and now with A Beautiful Anarchy are so, you know, they empower people. I feel as though, you know, I finished reading it and one of the things that came into mind was partly, I mean, I'm already living a creative life and partly thanks to you and the support that we get from Craft and Vision. But you touching it on the book that people often say to you that, you know, they really wish that they could be, you know, that they could do what you want to do. But a lot of people don't really, they want that without doing, you mentioned this, they want that without doing the work or giving, or the sacrifices that you've made to be able to live the life that you're leading. And so I think that, you know, in the book, you give people practical advice on how to actually live this life. And it's advice that they can use. It may be not, okay, if you do this, this will happen. But it's in a broader sense, you're empowering people to live the life that a lot of people want to live. And there's a lot to be said for the sacrifices. You know, the people don't want to give up their, as you say, they don't want to give up the television or the house and things like that. You lived your nomadic life for a long time. There's a lot of sacrifices to be made to live a life like this, if that's the way you choose to do it. But in some sense, there's always going to be sacrifices. And people generally don't want to make those sacrifices, but they want the end results of the life that you're living.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think, you know, when you find the things that you love, I don't know that they feel like sacrifices. I mean, they might initially, you know, when you tell people that maybe they should just stop spending less time on Facebook or television, it may feel that way. But I think I like to approach it from the other angle. I'm not sure people actually understand that living the life that they want to live is possible. And in many cases, I don't think they've given themselves permission to do that. And, you know, a lot of people will say, in fact, the person for whom I wrote this book in part was one of those people that say, well, I'm not really creative. This is a book about living a creative life in all of its, whether you're making a photograph, making a family, or making a business. It is about creativity. And I think we're all creative. And I think if people were given, and I hate saying given permission, but it works, I guess, in this case. If people understood that this was possible, they could have a life that was, if not the life that will fulfill them, because I'm not sure there's any one specific life that will fulfill us or that will be free of trouble or anything like that. In fact, I think the struggles and that sort of thing give our life more meaning, not less. Mm. But a life that they really, they love waking up every day and saying, I have meaningful work. I have something that I'm creating that I love. And yes, in some cases, they will feel that they have sacrificed something. But I generally feel like a sacrifice is giving up something really, really big for not really much in return. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it doesn't feel like a sacrifice. Otherwise, it just feels like an exchange.
Yeah.
I know that every choice I make in life as a creative person, if I want this one thing, whatever that is, there will be a price for it, either my time or my money or a lifestyle change or something, there will be a price for it. Mm. And I encourage people just to look very intentionally at that and realize, you know what, maybe you just start small. It's okay that you don't quit your day job and become a quote-unquote professional creative person. Mm. You could do it slowly and walk in through the back door and test the waters. There is no one way to do this. And again, that's this idea of a beautiful anarchy, that any force in our life that is controlling us, there are creative solutions around that. Mm. And so, yes, sacrifice, but I think more than that, it's giving up the lesser thing, like television, for the greater thing, which is the ability to create work we're proud of and to sustainably do that thing. Some people would so benefit from just like selling their house and putting the money in savings, renting something cheaper, and traveling and doing the things that they love. But there's a lot of scripts and patterns out there that people subscribe to without even knowing. They don't know that it's possible that they could have a different life, even with kids. You know, people say, oh, it's well and good that you can do this, but I have kids. Well, I've seen lots of stories of parents who pulled their kids out of schools, got on a sailboat and sailed around the world for a couple of years, or put the kids in an Airstream trailer and they tow the family around, you know, North America for a year or two or, you know, whatever. There's lots of alternate ways to do these things.
I think probably more than kids, I think getting the spouse on board is probably going to be the biggest problem for a lot of people. And I know that, I mean, I started small with my business. You know, the podcast and then just starting to grow my social media sort of footprint, as they say, got me to the point where I was able to start getting people on tours. And then that gave me the confidence to think, okay, well, maybe there's a living here. But for me, the biggest hurdle was not so much in myself and, you know, whether we call it a sacrifice or not. I mean, dumping a job that was paying a lot of money that a lot of people would love to be earning, and just saying, okay, I'm going to walk away from that and maybe earn a quarter or a third of that for at least a few years. That for me was not a sacrifice because it's something that I wanted to do. But for my wife, it was a big thing. You know, what do you think about that side of it? I mean, I'm sure that the majority of people, if you're married, you know, you've got to be able to talk someone else into living your dream with you.
I think so. I mean, it's a very complicated conversation when we get into, you know, relationships and marriages. The reality, I'm going to be completely honest. The reality is that there are some people that are, I'm gonna get anger mail from this. They're married to the wrong people. There are toxic relationships of all kinds out there. And so for some people, they are simply, their biggest problem is not, I want to do photography. Their biggest problem is you need to fix your relationship, however that is. Because if you have this burning dream and your partner's not on board with that, my feeling is if you finally get the courage up to say to your partner, this is what I dream about, they should say, well, it's about time, because I've known that for years. Mm. If this is a big surprise to them and they're shocked and horrified that you would want to, you know, drag the family through, well, you have bigger problems than photography or whatever creative endeavor that you have. So that's one thing. But I think ultimately, the book isn't encouraging people to divorce partners or anything. The book is encouraging people to find creative solutions. And there's this great line from a Chinese poet who said, what's in the way is the way. Mm. And so these obstacles, they are not a barrier to living your dreams. They will help shape how you live your dreams. Mm. So find a solution. Sit with your partner and say, okay, you know, this is what I dream of. Mm. Clearly you have a slightly different dream. Let's find a space in which these two dreams can best coexist. And maybe it's a progressive thing. We build to it over 5 years, but you cannot expect your partner to be on board with you being miserable. You can't. If they truly love you, they will want to find a solution for you. So I think initially, yes, there are a lot of fears and obstacles in the creative life. And one, I think if we're honest with them, and especially with the people in our lives, go to them and say, hey, I really want to try this. How can we make this work? What changes can we make? And, you know, because most families, it's financial, you know, most families that are photographers that have all of this gear, they have at least some disposable income. Mm. So the question is, if it's financial, the question is, how do we reduce our debt so that we have more income to spend on this kind of thing? Mm. How can we spend less, because money not spent is money earned, essentially? You know, can you over the next 3 years build slowly to being out of debt and having living well within your means? Maybe it's a question of app. Maybe the question is not relationships at all. Maybe it's really a question of you've been spending your money like a moron for 5 years and you need to spend a little. The price you're going to pay for living your dream is going to be paid up on the front end by you getting a part-time job and working a little harder to get out of the debt. Mm. Some people, they just don't want it badly enough to do that. Other people do. Mm. So, how do we really, I mean, it's relationships. It's like anything. You've got to find a creative way to do it. But the only way that's not acceptable is just running and hiding and not talking about it. Yeah. Because that's not getting anyone anywhere. And I think probably allows that relationship to continue in an atmosphere of, I don't know, inauthenticity, at least. I mean, I would imagine that the best relationships are those where each partner is free to dream and talk about how can we dream these dreams together. Mm. I don't know. I'm fortunate enough that, you know, that my partner and I dream similar kinds of dreams, and we enjoy traveling. We're hatching a plan now to spend 2016 traveling around the world, and we're just going to give up our place and I'll probably sell my Jeep and make the decisions I need to put us in a place where for that year we can travel around the world without coming back to a home. Mm. So, you know, life is confusing and complicated, and that's what creativity is about. Ultimately, it's problem solving. If you can't problem solve your way through some of these kind of relational problems or financial problems, then what are we bringing to the table as creative people when we approach our, you know, the visual arts or our music or whatever? Problem-solving skills are, you know, they're interdisciplinary and they cross all these boundaries.
Mm, mm. Yeah, that's such a profound answer. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here. I often find that when we talk or when I read your books, it's as though, I mean, obviously you add so much to the ideas that people have, but I often feel that you take all of the jumbled ideas and things that are in my head. It's like doing the laundry. You go off and you take all of my ideas, throw them in the washing machine, and then press and dry them and put them into little compartmentalized drawers for me. It's like, okay, this is how you should be thinking about this stuff. And you just did it again with what you said about the relationship. Because I mean, I'm fortunate that although my wife was horrified at the thought of me leaving a job that kept money in the bank and regular. It was a great job. I enjoyed doing it, but I loved photography more. And she could see that the day job was starting to eat away at my soul. And I mean, the work itself wasn't. It was all of the corporate crap that comes with it. And I just got really, really tired. At some points, I got really, really tired of having to deal with things that were totally out of my control. And, you know, I think that she saw that, and she knew that a change was coming. She, like you said, she knew that it was going to happen one day. And that's not to say that she was on board 100%. She was stressed out. And I remember her saying a couple of times over the first year where she sees me working from dawn until bedtime, you know, get up and then start working straight after breakfast. And I normally don't stop until my head hits the pillow at night. But she would say, so, okay, you're working like a dog. When's the money coming? Well, you know, when are we actually going to see some money come in? And I remember having this conversation. I mean, marketing, all of that, as you say, and it, you've said a lot of times, but in A Beautiful Anarchy as well, it's all creative pursuit. Building a business, you know, whatever you're creating, it's creative. And I would say to her, look, I can't say exactly. What I was going to say was, she'd often say, okay, what are you doing? What, you know, what are you actually spending your time on? I'm saying, I'm doing this. It's marketing. It's building tools for the back end. It's doing this. And she'll say, well, how can you map that to X amount of dollars or yen that is going to come into our bank account? Mm. And I'm saying, you can't. I'm sowing seeds. And I don't know exactly when those seeds are going to grow into flowers or whatever. I said, but they've got to be sown, because if you don't sow the seeds, then nothing's going to grow. You know, and it takes time. And so the first year was really a lot. It was a lot about that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you've hit on something that I think is so core to all of this discussion, whether you're talking about creativity as a photographer or as a business person or even in, you know, just in life in general. We are so addicted to certainty. Because there is an illusion of safety in certainty. It feels that way. I'm not sure that there's any more safety in certainty than there is uncertainty, but, you know, we don't like the unknown, you know, because, you know, we think we're certain that we have a corporate job that's going to be there tomorrow, but it might not.
Oh, yeah.
And some egghead running the company or some shareholder or stakeholder may make a decision that into which we don't factor. And suddenly that very certain job is gone. Our health, you know, we think everything's so great until it's not. And I think for the creative, if you can take certainty off the table as a guarantee and see it for the illusion that it is, and realize that we're always working in uncertainty, whether we're creating a piece of art, like you're writing a book, and you don't know whether it's going to come off. It could be a total flop. That flop could teach you the things you need then to make that best-selling book, or, you know, that personal project that finally gets you whatever it is you're hoping for, the recognition or the exposure. You really don't know. But I think if we go in, and I talk about this in the book, I talk about fear and risk, and everything is a risk. And the question is, what risk can I afford to pay, and what can I not? For everyone, it'll be different. But I can't, for me, the risk, people say, oh, you're so, you know, you travel the world, and what about the risk? And I remind them, well, I travel to all of these places where, you know, the U.S. State Department on their website says, you know, that American citizens shouldn't travel to, and there's travel advisors. I go to all those places completely safe, and it's in, you know, it's in Tuscany, Italy, that I get medically evacuated. Nobody warned me about Tuscany. You know, I thought I knew where the risks lay and where they didn't. And the reality is, we never really truly know where the risks lie. Of course, it could be argued that I probably should have stayed off the wall. But I guess what I'm saying is, part of the, we will never be free from the fear. We will never be free from partners that say, where's the money coming from? But we have to, part of the job of a creative is to find a new relationship with uncertainty and trust the process and work. I mean, creative people, the ones that are paying their bills and aren't whining about, you know, stock markets, you know, the stock photography market or whatever thing they're, you know, they haven't been discovered, whatever thing that creative people sometimes whine about. The creative ones that are making it, whatever their definition of making it is, are the ones that are working their asses off to do it, right? This is not about pie in the sky stuff. This is ultimately about, if you're serious about being a creative, you're going to work harder than the guy who's just working for some corporate paycheck.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's your thing, and you are now solely responsible to put the money on the table. And I think ultimately learning to approach uncertainty, learning to approach fear and risk, these are the things that keep people from living their most creative life. And because they think that by not choosing to step into that known risk, that they are avoiding risk entirely. Of course they're not, because if you choose not to step into, say, the life of a world traveler, you are staying in the risk of getting to the end of your life and never having done the thing you wanted to do. So there's a risk on both sides. The big question is, which one are you prepared to die knowing that you've spent your life on? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get to the end of my life with regrets for things that I have not done. Mm-hmm. Life is very short, and anyone that's, you know, and maybe it's a midlife crisis, I don't know, but 40 years old, you start looking at half of that life gone. Did I do the things I wanted to in that 40 years? Mm. Because the next 40 is going to go by just as fast, if not faster. And yeah. It will only, my photographs will only be what they are when I approach them intentionally and with vision. My life will only be what it will one day become. I will only become the person I'm going to with intention. Mm. And that part of that intention is reacting to life circumstances, because I know full well that not everything goes the way we plan. In fact, I have a very low regard for planning and goal setting. Mm. And a much bigger regard for very short-term, actionable, just do the things that you want to do, and they will accumulate into things that we never expected.
Mm. Yeah, wow. I've got a couple of things that I'm going to have to say before I forget them, because I'm terrible for this. One is that, you know, on something that you just mentioned, they say that our perspective or how we feel, you know, they say time gets faster as you get older. I read somewhere, and obviously I don't know if this is true, it's probably just conjecture, but they say that a year in our life always feels like a fraction of the whole. So when you're 5 years old, if you're going to live to your 70, say when you're 5 years old, that's like a 1/14th of your life gone. But when you're 40 years old, or 35 years old, that's half of your life gone. You know, so you know, and as you get closer to the 70, obviously you're almost at 100%. So, you know, I can relate to that. I mean, I don't think it's midlife crisis as such, but it's, you know, that when you're in your 40s, we both are. It's like it's one of those times where you know that there's only a finite amount of time left, and we both a couple of years ago almost had that like rubbed out in a couple of seconds. It was a strange time for the both of us. So, you know, I mean, you've got to make the most of what, I mean, I would have hated, like, I think I've mentioned this before, but when I found out I had that brain tumor, the first time I actually cried was when I realized I'd not been to Africa yet. I'd got a main bucket list of three places, Antarctica, Iceland, and Africa. And I had just come back from Antarctica when we found that I'd got the tumor, and the first time I cried was when I realized I'd not stood on the red soil of Africa and smelt the dust and that whole thing. That was what made me cry. So it was like, as you say, it was a regret for something that I'd not done. Fortunately, I've been to Iceland as well, and I made these things happen because it was something that I didn't want to leave this life without doing. But the other thing that that kind of leads into it, the other thing that I just thought of, you were talking about the risk and how you know you almost lost your life in Tuscany. This is really just a funny story, but I remember when I got to Africa, one of the things that we were photographing one day was wild horses, and it was, you know, obviously there are no real wild horses in Africa, but some of the early settlers had taken horses that escaped, and there's now herds of wild horses. And a friend of mine from the west coast of the US was standing there, and one of the horses was getting a little bit feisty as we were photographing them, and he said, "Wouldn't that be uncool? You come all the way to Africa and get killed by a horse." Yeah, there's so many other things that could kill you, but I'm just sitting here getting all topped up creatively again by the conversation. You talked about risk, and I remember doing some in my old job. We did some financial training, and one of the things that the guy there, he talked about risk one evening. It was like a night school thing that I went to once a week for a while. This guy talked about risk, and he said, what's the risk involved in jumping in front of a speeding train or something like that? And everyone's saying, well, that's really risky. And he said, no, there's no risk. You will die. There's no question about it. There's 0% risk because you know the outcome the moment you jump in front of that train. You're going to die, but what you perceive as the risk is something different. And so, you know, that, I don't know, there's just a few things that came into my mind as you were talking there.
Well, I think it's true. And I think it comes back to our relationship with what is certain and what is uncertain. We want so much for things to be certain. Yeah. And the older I get, the more relaxed I am about my need for certainty. And in fact, the more I enjoy sort of the mystery and the wonder of uncertainty. Now, I'm the first to admit that some of that comes with kind of getting your financial house in order and getting, you know, being free of debt and having some sort of some apparent safety nets around me. But at the same time, I think to say, well, that's is not achievable simply because I have debt. The first thing is just get out of that debt. I mean, we have such a short life, and as far as we know, one of them. It pays to get ruthless with everything that holds us back, that has a power of control over our lives, whether that's unhealthy relationships, whether it's finances or our relationship with fear. The more we can, I think, consciously address fear and uncertainty, the more interesting our art will be. And the more risks we will take. But also, I think, you know, where the risks are greater, the rewards are greater. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is this idea of the hero's journey, which is kind of a way of discussing stories and common patterns in stories, at least in Western civilization. And the thing that I love about it is it basically says, the hero's journey says everyone is the hero of their own story. And every story starts with a refusal of the call. Everyone is called to something and says, no, that's, you know, I can't possibly do it. That's not for me. I'm not creative would be kind of the refusal of the call. And yet there's something that eventually pulls them into the story. And story is driven forward by by the longing, the thing that the hero wants or is trying to achieve. And two, the obstacles that come up. The obstacles never stop the hero, at least if in a good story, because otherwise it's just the end of the movie. We all go home kind of wondering what we spent our $20 on. But the obstacles provide ways for the hero to see himself in a new light, to change, to grow, to get closer to the goal, and to do so in a way that changes them. And I think the creative life is about change. It's about becoming the people that we're becoming. But it is a journey, and there are obstacles, and it's not easy. But I really think if people were more willing to address this issue of uncertainty and fear, there would be maybe in some ways sort of a greater joy in the exploration of art rather than just, you know, nice capture man and, you know, people competing. And instead of competing, they might be more willing to just trust their own voice and go out and make the art that they want to instead of worrying about what pleases judges, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Do you think that there's, I mean, I know that one of the conversations that me and my wife have had over the last few years as well is she'll often say, where does your confidence come from? And I think that one of the reasons that I'm able to cope with the risks or the uncertainty of living this kind of life is because I'm confident that no matter what happens, even if, you know, say hopefully an extreme example, even if I was to go blind, you know, obviously I know that there are blind photographers, but, you know, in general, it's going to be a tough job to do if you can't see.
I would imagine.
So I'm pretty confident that no matter what happens, I'm not going to fail to the point where I end up living under a bridge or something. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I'm confident that I could probably even go back into my old job if necessary, heaven forbid. That would be soul destroying. But, you know, I'm pretty sure before all of that, that I'm going to be able to continue to, you know, run the business and live the life that I'm planning and I'm already living to a degree. I'm just confident in my ability to make it happen and to continue to make art and to continue to be creative about how I run my business. So do you think that confidence is a part of it?
I think it is, but I think I think it's not as simple as that. I think for people that are listening that maybe don't feel that they have confidence to say, well, I don't have confidence and so that's my excuse. Mm-hmm. There's never an excuse for not creating art. There are people that make art of their lives by, you know, mountain climbing with only two arms and no legs. And mm-hmm. there are blind rock climbers and there are painters that paint with their feet. And mm-hmm. when I look at what people do, and there's a whole chapter in the book about embracing constraints, both in the creative process and just as a way of life. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately there are never any excuses. The great art of history has been created by all kinds of people, from syphilitic, you know, bums in the streets of Paris to rulers of empires and everything in between. Helen Keller, my gosh, if she's not an example of someone who's, you know, and she said that life is either a daring adventure or it is nothing. And if she has that perspective, I think all of us can. But I do think that confidence is the kind of thing that we can get. It's sort of an asset that's waiting out there for us to find, but it's not achieved by doing easy things. It's achieved by doing hard things. I am more confident in my ability to survive the things that life throws at me every time life throws something nasty at me, and I bounce back and I survive it. And I think, you know what? I can do this. I have now, in the last 3 years, learned to walk again 3 times, and I'm in the middle of it now, and. Yeah. It is not easy every time. You think, man, haven't we done this before? Haven't we gone through this? And, you know, you go in for another surgery or whatever, and all of those things you need to relearn. Mm-hmm. But every time I have greater confidence that I know how to do this. I can do this. Mm-hmm. I will. It'll take time. And, you know, one of the things that I say in the book is we need to be patient with unfinished things. Mm-hmm. Part of that is in reference to our art. We need to not, for example, write off a bad idea just because it sounds like a bad idea, because it's bad ideas that bring us to good ideas. Mm. One idea may in fact be bad, but you keep it around for long enough and it'll connect with another truly bad idea. Mm. And the combination of the two might actually be world-changing. Mm. Our ideas, our work, the things when we finish our work, whether it's a photograph or a book or whatever, the thing that we finish with is not what we started with. Mm. And to judge it as, you know, oh, this idea is bad, this art, this photograph sucks, whatever it is we say, to do that prematurely is unfair to the work, because mm-hmm. we haven't yet allowed it to become what it is. It's like saying about a 3-year-old, you know, oh, this human being sucks. Mm-hmm. Well, he's 3 years old, for crying, like, give him some time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the same thing with the artist. We ourselves are unfinished things, and we need to be patient with ourselves. We need to not just simply judge ourselves by the fact that we've had one failure. Oh, well, I'm not very good at those things. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, how many light bulbs did it take before Thomas Edison came up with a working model? If he'd failed in the first 50, he still would have been 50 away from that viable thing. Mm. The process takes time. We need to be patient with ourselves as well. Yeah. So, you know, the 19 or 20 year old that approaches me and says, you know, I feel like I've been working on my art forever and I'm not getting anywhere. Mm. I kind of go, you're 19, you're 20. And I get the feeling, I get the frustration, but you got to allow yourself to, you know, that's like tasting a wine that's like literally just been smashed and put in a bottle. Mm. Hey, leave the cork in, put it in the rack and allow it to season, allow it to become the thing it will eventually become. Right now it's not wine, it's grape juice. you know, the example so you can't say this wine's terrible. Well, yeah, but it's not wine. It's grape juice. Yeah. And I give the example in the book of saying, you know, if what you really want is a butterfly, but you can't stand caterpillars and you go around smashing caterpillars, you're never going to get a butterfly. And it's definitely a trite metaphor, but I think it works because ultimately the thing that is that we're creating, whether it's ourselves or our art or a lifestyle or whatever, it doesn't look like what it will become. So we need to be patient and nurture new things and give them their time. And that includes ourselves. Give yourself time to fail and hit rock bottom and bounce up. And life's not easy. And it's definitely not tidy, you know, but then neither is the creative process.
Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly where, you know, as I was saying, confidence comes from. Like you said, you get more confident that you can overcome things by overcoming things. You know, so it all makes so much sense.
Yeah. And I think, Martin, I think confidence is a form of, it's sort of, you know, you call it, you kind of brand it as personal bravery.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And bravery, again, I talk about in the book, I've become that guy. It's just, you know, as I said in my book, but fear, bravery is not the absence of fear. Brave, you know, we don't look at a guy who's brave, who has no fear in his life. Hmm. We say that a person is brave or has courage when they have things that are to be feared and in fact are afraid of, but they act anyway. And there's this great scene in The Ghost in the Darkness, this Michael Douglas movie, where at one point he's heading off, he's playing the hunter Remington, he's in Africa, and he's got to kill these two big kind of rogue man-eating lions. Hmm. And he's sitting around the campfire with his, you know, a couple of his buddies, and then sort of just behind him, there's a ring of Maasai warriors, and they're jumping up and down and they're singing. Mm. And he says, I'm going to go now. We're all going to convince ourselves that we're brave. And the guy says, well, I wouldn't have thought bravery would be an issue for someone like you. And he says, well, you always hope it isn't, but you never know. And I really think that to some degree, you know, we're all kind of pretending to be brave. It's not that we live without fear. It's not that we live without concerns or doubts. It's that we live with those things and a very human ability to say yes, but, you know, in as much as the creative effort is very often kind of following that question, what if? Courage is often answered, you know, we answer the fear with the yes, but, you know, you could die on that wall in Italy. Yeah, but, you know, I might live and look at this great angle, look at this great photograph. you know, it's, again, a very tried example. It's funny, Martin, you know, I went back into the archives of my blog, and the blog post that I wrote about my accident, the initial kind of one where I kind of told everyone, it was called And Then I Fell, and it had, you know, pictures of me in the hospital and stuff. Yeah. But the one immediately before it was written, I don't know, literally like a week before that one. And it was called Choose Your Own Risk, I think. And it was all about living, you know, living a much more intentional life and being okay with risk. And so I realize there's a lot of people that are saying, yeah, but I don't want to, you know, do life-threatening stuff. I think we're not talking about that. We're talking about the risks that are inherent with putting yourself out there as a creative person. Mm-hmm. And the risk that's inherent in saying to your partner, you know, your example earlier, Martin, saying to your partner, I'm really unhappy at work and I think there's something more for us. Mm-hmm. I think we've settled and I think we can achieve more, and let's talk about how we can do that. That can be a very scary thing. It can be a very scary thing to put your images out for criticism, you know, to approach a mentor and say, I need you to give me an honest assessment of my work. It can be very scary to read your Amazon reviews, you know. I mean, there's a lot of these things. I'm not talking about the big stuff, because fear isn't relative. It's not gauged on 1 to 10. You either fear something or you don't, and there may be subtle shades of that, but you know, I remember being in grade 7 and the fear of talking to a girl. I mean, I'd rather jump off that wall in Italy again than, you know, than be back there and experiencing that level of anxiety over something. So I think it's important that we don't kind of put our fears on a scale of 1 to 10 and say, well, I should be more brave. But nonsense. If you're terrified by something, you're terrified. But I do think that we can approach things that are new in our life. Like, you know, how many of us go to work or you know, our regular grocery store or whatever, the same way every single time? We're creatures of habit. And my encouragement to people is, in your creativity, in your life, break out, you know, learn a new language, eat a new food. Every time you say, well, I don't really like that, or I'm scared of that, face it, you know. Don't just kind of shove it back in the box. Face it and go, all right, we're going to tackle that. A fun example, and this is, you know, it's silly, but it's a side note, but when I was in the hospital, my partner Cynthia, we had literally been sort of together for a week, and she said, you know, I know this is a silly question, but is there anything I can do for you? I said, yeah, when you get back to San Diego, I want you to go skydiving, because we had been talking about our fears and that sort of thing. And she did. And I said, the only condition is I want to see before and after pictures, and I want you to tell me about it. And she had an absolute blast. But I think everyone should go and go skydiving. I've skydived. I was a rock climber for years, and people say, well, I couldn't do that, I'm scared of heights. I said, I'm terrified of heights. You know, it's probably what makes me a safer rock climber.
Yeah.
you know, I always have been sort of nervous around heights. I'm my worst on a 6 foot ladder. I mean, forget walls in Italy and rock climbing, you know, a 6 foot ladder terrifies me. So anyway, it's, you know, ultimately I think our relationship with fear, if we can just grapple with that one thing, not that that is what the book is about in its entirety, but it's an aspect, it's one of the things that holds us back.
Yeah. I know that, you know, there are, again, so many things that I want to say there. I'll just mention a couple of things. That one, that, you know, I think as a, even though I mentioned confidence, I'm still thinking that exactly what you're saying. It's not that you don't go into everything thinking this is going to go great. I get scared. I want to swear, but I'm not going to. I get really scared and apprehensive about a lot of things. It's not as though I'm sitting here thinking, okay, well, I'm just going to do this and it's all going to go great. It's not. That's not what I'm meaning by confidence. It's exactly what you're saying. You know, you do things that you know that it might not go well. But what I think the point I was trying to make is, and I'm not sort of saying this in reply to what you say, really, in addition to what you were saying. I think that when I talk about confidence, it's more about confidence that even if something goes really, really badly, I can get over it. I can overcome either the rejection or the, you know, the wasted time or, you know, whatever it is, the negative outcome, if it doesn't go as well as I'd hoped. So, you know, that all really ties in really well with the way I'm thinking about this.
I totally agree. I think your definition of confidence is right on. And I think I'd take it a step further and say, not if it doesn't work, but when it doesn't work.
Yes.
Because none of our endeavors that are worth anything always come off the first time. You write three or four first drafts. You cross out paragraphs. You go on a photo shoot and you shoot 3,000 images and you come back with 100 maybes and 12 oh my gosh, these are amazing.
Yeah.
Do you then say, well, I'm a really bad photographer because I shot all this crap? Or is that just the price of admission? Is our failure, in fact, the best teacher? And I think failure is a more faithful teacher than success. If you immediately succeed at something, I wonder, A, if you're pushing your boundaries, if you're not just repeating yourself, and B, what would happen if you risked a little, maybe failed a couple times and then learned. There's a statistic that says, you know, a lot of these really rich people ended up bankrupt once or twice before they became. And now, is that just because all people that are really successful in business were just really stupid at one point? Well, aren't we all? It's that they failed so colossally, made some course corrections and learned from that failure that eventually they would become the person that didn't need those particular lessons. But those particular lessons are the most faithful. I guarantee you fall off your bike a couple times, you're going to start to think, maybe I shouldn't do that anymore.
Maybe
I should stay on top of it. And you will be much more highly motivated to learn to ride your bike than, I don't know what the alternative is, than what I was going to say, than just, you know, picking it up and riding it the first time. But nobody does that. It is the hard lessons that are the most faithful.
Yeah, absolutely. So in A Beautiful Anarchy, a couple of pages in, you talk about becoming more selfish in that, you know, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but we should extend the same love and grace to ourselves that we do others, and even before others. And that's really, you know, you're saying it puts us in a good place to love other people and to extend grace to other people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I find, I think selfishness has been given a bad name. I think there certainly is a type of selfishness, I think, which people rightly have issues with. But don't you think it's interesting that when someone says, oh, you're just being selfish, that what the pain point that has ignited that comment is actually their own selfishness? What they're saying is, you're not serving me the way I expected you to serve me. I find that interesting. More to the point, I think that as an artist, as a human being, we need to acknowledge the things that we want. We have one life. Mm-hmm. What do you want? That doesn't mean you have to act on it. But I think not recognizing your desires and your longings in any endeavor sets us up for what's your motivation to do anything if you haven't looked at what you do and do not want to accomplish? What's your roadmap in life? Mm-hmm. If you... I think a lot of people probably get married because it's expected of them, or they get a regular job because it's expected of them. Mm. And well, I wouldn't want to disappoint my parents. Well, yeah. I get that, but do your parents? Do they really want you to live their life, the life they didn't have? And will you be happy when you're 80 years old and on your deathbed thinking, I really wish that I had lived the life I longed for, you know? And I kind of think about the Monty Python sketch where the guy's a hairdresser and he's like, I don't want to be a hairdresser. I just want to be a lumberjack, you know, leaping from tree to tree. Yeah. Yeah. As funny as that example is, I think the freedom of acknowledging your desires and putting yourself first puts you in a place where you will create better, more authentic art, where you will raise healthier, more responsible children, where you will create a more ethical and successful business, be a better global citizen. Now, you could, of course, turn that around and say, well, you could also be a selfish guy that's just a total jerk. Well, that's true. But they were going to be selfish anyway. I didn't need to address my comments to them. I want to encourage people to call it something different. Mm-hmm. Just understand that the people in your life that love you and afford you dignity and grace and patience and kindness, you should afford that to yourself because it's from there that you will at least identify the things you long for. And my business model is very simple. My business model and my manager, Corwin, and I talk about it regularly is hell yes or no. And I learned this from a guy named Derek Sivers who he wrote a book and I can't remember what it was called, but he created CD Baby, which grew to be a very successful company, eventually gave it away. And the reason I love this hell yes or no thing is because it roots my decision making, at least initially, in my desires and in my longings, what feels right to me. It's not the only thing that affects it, but if it's not a hell yes, I don't move forward. If I'm not in touch with what do I want to do, right? That doesn't make me selfish in a negative way. That's like saying that Gandhi, when he said, what do I want to do with my life, said, I want to fight for the independence of India. Well, that's really selfish, you know. What would your parents think? Well, his parents were, you know, may not have been on board. His society weren't on board. A lot of people will not be on board with the things you want to do. But will you be happy when you die and realize you were not faithful to your nature? You know, what if Galileo had not done the things he did in spite of the criticisms? What if the Impressionist painters had gone a different way because the Salon in Paris said, that's not how paintings are done? You know, there's a lot of should in our life, and I'm not sure that there's really any place for that should. Yes, you should pay your taxes, but does that mean you have to take it like a martyr and pay every single tax instead of getting a corporate status and paying less taxes? I mean, does it mean that we can't be open to loopholes and doing life the way we want to do it? Particularly if, and I would say, you know, in from my own ethic, you know, as long as no one else is getting hurt, you know, I think my rights stop at the end of someone else's personal space. You know, the selfishness thing, so many people do not accomplish the things in their life or even give time to the things that they want to give, like being a creative person. I could spend more time writing if I didn't feel so obligated. Well, are those obligations real or are they perceived? And is it someone else saying, you shouldn't be so selfish, by which they mean, if you make this change in your life, I'm going to have to start picking up some of my own pieces. We're very interconnected, and it's not an easy way to... It's not none of these things are easy, but I think we need to think about them. And, you know, we're in this book, there are some rabbit trails that get us a long way from photography and creating things, you know, books, pottery, whatever. But I think if we don't address the core aspects of who is the creator and what is his relationship to the world around him, I think we have failed to consider that that's actually where our creation comes from. And imagine how much better your art would be if you were not constrained to things you don't need to be constrained to. You know, and I think ultimately that gives us better art. It allows us to be better parents, better citizens, better artists, whatever. When you recognize, because then you're authentic, then you're being true to yourself, rather than just living this lie that you spent a great deal of energy sort of trying to cover up and trying to make up for your deficiencies, living a way that you were never meant to live.
Incredible. So I have a note here, and with a little bit of fear that it might throw us back into something that we've already covered. At one point,
I'm not scared. Bring it on.
At one point in the book, you used the phrase "the chronically employed," and I just wanted to say that I love that term. I'm going to be using that. It's brilliant. The chronically employed.
Well, you know, for so long, my parents would say, you know, when are you going to get a real job? Because, I mean, you know, I ran off to theology school for 5 years and then I became a comedian for 12. And I mean, I've never had a job. I have always worked. That's not true. I've had some part-time little things earlier on in life. But as an adult, I've never had gainful employment. But I think we make a mistake when we think that a job and work are the same thing. You know, I have meaningful work that makes me money and I run a business, but I don't see it as a job. I see it as my life's work. And I think people would be happier. Not everyone wants to do that, but you can still do your life's work in the context of being employed by someone else. I would love to see people drop this whole job thing and look at the pieces of their life and go, you know, this part of my life is my work. And work gives us meaning. I don't want to make it seem like creativity is just this kind of anarchic free for all, this kind of love in with the muse. It's hard work. Really is. But I do, because I've never been in that position. I do see chronic employment I sort of eye it with a little bit of suspicion and wonder how does the other half live? You know, I can't imagine being at work at 8 o'clock in the morning and coming home at five. And I mean, when would I nap? I fail to understand the concept.
Well, that's something else. I mean, you just touched on that. When I first started doing this, both myself and my wife had a problem with the work ethic of someone that's, you know, self-employed, however we call it, running your own business. Because I would, you know, obviously I get up, we have breakfast. I generally actually check email for anything urgent at the moment I wake up. I pick the iPhone up, have a quick flick through and make sure there's nothing that I haven't got to jump onto before breakfast. And then we'll have breakfast and then the laptop comes over and I'll spend another hour downstairs. Then I come up into the office. You know, we have a routine, but there were times when, you know, I mean, I work so hard most of the time that you can get worn out. And even when I was in my old job as a manager, managing, you know, IT and engineers, I would say to people, you know, you've got to make sure that you give yourself time to rest. And if you don't rest, then you're not going to be as productive as you would be anyway. And what you just said, you know, when am I going to have time for a nap? We had a real problem with, you know, sometimes you just have to walk away from it, give yourself an hour to just calm down, to rethink and to reset even. And you mentioned in the book, you know, you're free in the life that you have. You're free to have a nap in the middle of the day or to go for a walk. That was something that I do now. But, you know, if I really feel that I need to reset, I might go for a walk around the block, down the river, or I might even like keel over on the sofa for half an hour. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that you really, from the chronically employed perspective, you can't do. You know, you don't think, it's not something that you're able to do in a normal job. But in this way of life, I think it's not only acceptable, it's something that you should give yourself permission to do, because it generally, you know, I can often come back from one of those walks or even come back from 10 minutes in the shower with the answer to something that I have been struggling with for the whole week.
Sure. Well, I think whether you work for someone else or not is not relevant. I mean, it is in the sense that if you work for yourself, you'll have greater freedom for that nap. But ultimately, in terms, the Industrial Revolution did us no favors. Huh. You know, it set us on a treadmill that people have been trying to escape from ever since. And one of the books that I've sort of pretty crazy about is Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. Mm. And one of the things I love about it is it takes sort of this unconventional approach and encourages people to work smarter, not harder. Mm. And it looks at people that have convinced their employers to let them either work entirely from home and telecommute as a full-time mm. lifestyle, or to mm. do it part-time, you know, maybe on a Friday and a Monday, giving you a longer weekend. Yeah. And people are more efficient. They get more done in a better quality yeah. when they do it according to their own creative rhythms. Yeah. I know, for example, that I am absolute garbage from sort of lunch to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Sometimes mm. it's sort of 1 o'clock to four. But that there's a space in the afternoon that my brain just goes, you know what? I'm not interested. Mm-hmm. And that's the time that if I push through the work, I would get the work done, but it would not be of the best quality. Mm-hmm. If I abandon the work and go for a walk, have a workout, have a nap, mm-hmm. Meet a friend for a drink, and then resume that work, mm-hmm. the work that I might have got done in that 3 hours will take me maybe an hour and a half, mm-hmm. and it will be better.
Yeah.
So and everyone will be different. Everyone will work according to different, you know, maybe you need to, some work you could, like, for example, if I'm in a period where I'm writing, I will generally get up in the morning, have my coffee, and I will write. Mm. And because the morning is a good time for me to do that. Mm. I can also do it in the evening, but in the middle of the day, I can't. Mm. I can do in the middle of the day other tasks that are less creative, like reply to email. I don't need to be creative when I reply to email. I just need to reply to them and get them off the shelves. So I've become very careful, very intentional about my use of time. I won't check my email 300 times a day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still check it more than I should, but I'm getting better at it. I'm getting much better at checking Facebook and staying on task when I check Facebook to not go into the sort of that home feed where it's just all a bunch of random, you know, ramblings from people that, you know, you call your friends, but you've never actually met. Because you get sucked into this kind of thing, and then you get sucked into comments, and soon half an hour is gone and you're angry. Mm. And I'm learning to identify what my own rhythms are. And I think anyone can have that. I think even if you work a full-time job, you can recognize where your rhythms are, reschedule your day. And most people, I think, even have the freedom to go to their boss and say, you know, can I make some particular changes in the way that I work in order to be more productive? Mm. And ultimately, maybe that leads to you being allowed to telecommute 1 or 2 days a week, mm. freeing up some of that time. And I mean, most people, that if you telecommuted Monday and Friday, you could get all your work done on Monday and have Friday off, or yeah. vice versa, because yeah. we tend to be a little more motivated when suddenly there's something to be gained yeah. rather than just, well, I've got to stay in this office for 8 hours no matter what, so I may as well just stretch it out.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. At one point in the book, you make a point about the difference between pain and harm. And this is one of those, another place where I'm sitting there nodding my head thinking, wow, that's just, I couldn't agree more. Can you talk to us a little bit about that difference that you talked about in the book?
Yeah, I think we generally fear hurt. We organize our daily lives, whether it's the artistic endeavors or just our relationships or whatever, we organize them in such a way to minimize hurt. And we spend a lot of fear on whether something will or will not hurt. Mm. And I think that a lot of our, a lot of that would be reduced if we could understand that the things that hurt us, in relation to what I said earlier, you know, our failures are most often our best and most faithful teachers. Mm. Failure is always accompanied by hurt, mm. Or almost all. I don't know when failure is not accompanied by hurt. It certainly is in my case, mm. in some fashion, whether it's emotional or whatever. Yeah. But does it hurt to get a stinging critique from someone that mentors you that then pushes you into a place of greater honesty and vulnerability and making the best work of your life? Mm-hmm. Yes, it hurts, but is it, I mean, it's is it harmful? Absolutely not. In fact, it's beneficial. Mm. And where I had this realization and where I sort of reference it in the book is specific to my own recovery from this accident and getting massage therapy. And you know, people hear that I go for massage once or twice a week and they say, oh, it must be nice. Lady, if you knew what they do to me when I'm on that massage table, it hurts a great deal. It's not a relaxing Swedish massage. They are stripping layers of muscle apart. They're stripping scar tissue off of bone. I mean, they're doing things that were I not trusting of the process, I would be lying there screaming.
Yeah.
But when you trust and the fear goes away and you go, you know what? This does hurt, but it's not going to harm me. Mm. In fact, it may do me some really needed good, either in my creative life or in my personal life or whatever. So if we could step back and just even count to 10 and ask ourselves, is this thing that I so fear, is it, and I know it's going to hurt, but is it going to harm? Mm. Or is it just going to be, because it's just, pain is just a sensation. I mean, your brain tells you that, you know, life as you know it is over, but it is just a sensation. Mm. And if you are not fearful, I have found that I can lie on that massage bed and my massage therapist, Tessa, can do some really painful things to me that I can almost relax myself into. I'm not quite there yet, but I don't clinch up. I know, yes, this is going to hurt like a bugger, but it's not going to hurt me. Mm. I mean, it's not going to harm me.
Yeah.
And that difference for me has made, it has been significant in everything that I've done when I realized that, yes, I might fail at this. Mm. And yes, it might hurt, but it's not going to harm me. In fact, it may do me benefit. And that allows me to go in. You know, when I talk about courage being the willingness to act in spite of our fear, it gives me a little bit of a push. It's something behind me going, go on, you can do this. It might hurt, but the hurt part is kind of all in your head, except for the times I end up in hospital. and even then, you know, did I come out of that? Let's refer back to this idea of the hero's journey. Mm. Did I come out of that with a better story? Yes. Did the hero grow? Yes. Did he come back with the magic sword or did he slay the dragon? Yeah, he did. Mm. And so because it's so much more important for me to live a great story than just to watch one on the television, I'm willing to at least allow myself to see where these adventures are going to go. And if I can look at the potential hurt and ask myself, is it just hurt or is it harm? That gives me one more way of making my decision. Mm. You know, do I want to go all in on this or do I need to be a little more cautious? I'm all for being cautious when caution is due. Mm. I think more often than not, we're overcautious. We're unduly cautious in the areas in our life that would reap really big benefits and probably where the resulting hurt or harm wouldn't be that significant. It's in a lot of cases, it's worth the risk. It's just like falling in love. What if she rejects me? Is it going to hurt? My God, is it going to hurt? Oh, yeah. You know, it'll feel like someone ripping my heart out of my chest. Will it harm me? Well, that's kind of a matter of how I react. That's my choice.
Yeah.
But is it worth the risk? Mm. Oh, I guess everyone's got to answer that for themselves. But, you know, when people say, is it better to have loved than lost than never to love at all? I think, are you crazy? Mm. Is that really a question? What human being says no, it's better to just protect yourself and never connect.
You know, as you were talking there again, you mentioned trust, you know, in your therapy masseur, or however you would call her, but you know that you said that because you trust her, you're okay with that process. And if you hear from someone that you don't know even whether they're a half decent photographer or whatever, and someone tells you that your image is crap, you know, you think, okay, well, you know, so yes, you know, that could be devastating to some people. But if you hear from someone that you really trust and they say that your image is crap, then that's going to, you know, you're going to react to that in a much different way. You might not think it is. And if you love your art and you're happy with what you're creating, then even if someone that you really trust tells you it's crap, I don't think you need to change it. But I think that it's important when we ask for feedback on our work that you get it from someone that you trust. And that's the part that I just thought about as you were mentioning that. You know, just unless you trust the person that you're actually getting feedback from, I really think that it's, you know, you don't know where, conversely, if it's not someone that you trust, you don't know where that advice or that feedback's coming from. It could be from malice or, you know, from envy or whatever. People react. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a great point. And it loops back into, you know, another conversation in the book about the voices that we listen to. Mm. And I think absolutely. I think one of the reasons that we just get so upset when anybody critiques our work is that we're actually more, we're more in love with our ego than we are with the work. We are more concerned that our ego is, that we are told that, oh my gosh, you're exactly this amazing artist, rather than, yes, you are a really good artist, but this is beneath you. Mm. And rather than saying, you know what, you're absolutely right, let's talk about how I can make this better, our ego gets hurt. And that's, you know, that's up to every individual what you want to do with your ego. But my kind of feeling is my ego doesn't need any protecting. Mm. And that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. Doesn't mean I don't see the red mist like everyone else does when someone says something about my work. But the question is, can this be helpful? Mm. What can I make of, and I feel that about everything that happens in life. Can I, rather than reacting and being a victim or whatever, can I use this? Can I learn from it? Can the hero of this particular journey get a little further ahead by that nugget? And there may be something in that criticism, even if it's spoken out of jealousy or malice, there may be something in there. Mm. Or maybe there's not. Maybe I look at it and go, you know what? That guy's full of crap. And I didn't invite. So I think there's also a place for being very intentional about the voices that we listen to and inviting people. Because let's face it, you ask a million photographers their opinion about your photograph, you're going to get a million different answers. Yeah. Do they matter? No, they don't. They don't matter at all, because your work is not going to be for everyone. It truly won't. So the person that you want to ask is the person that you respect, that does work that you love, even if it's not the same kind of thing remotely. Mm. Someone that's an amazing potter, and you see something human and very sort of, you know, wabi-sabi in their work, and you want that in your photography. Mm. Yeah. That's when you bring your work to that person and say, can you tell me how this work speaks to you? Tell me what you see and take that feedback. Mm. But the person that comes uninvited into our life and just kind of rains on our parade, you just need to have the kind of the fortitude to just say, you know, I appreciate the fact that you feel the obligation to tell me what you think about my work. Mm-hmm. But I'm actually listening to different voices right now, and be kind of ruthless about it. And I think more importantly, one of course is that we choose the voices we listen to either for good or for like, or don't choose, like intentionally choose the ones we don't listen to. Mm-hmm. But I think in all of that, we need to become very good at hearing our own voice, because isn't that why we're here? I mean, isn't that why we're creating these things, is to do it in a way that aligns with who we are? Yeah. And so many people listen to so many voices, and they drown out our own voice. Our own voice is just this one little voice that gets lost in the crowd, because we're listening to all these other voices. We're on 500px or Flickr or God help us, Facebook and Twitter, asking people for opinions, you know. And there's this new website out there right now called Pixotto, I think it's called, and people are submitting their images. They're getting paid. It's allegedly a micro stock agency. It's like nano stock, and they're getting paid almost nothing. But people are being encouraged to kind of, here's three images, you know, vote for the best one, kind of thing. And people are Twittering and Facebooking, oh, my image just won the, you know, won three best images on Pixotto. And I'm thinking, but I mean, that is the worst possible place to be getting advice, because one, they're all a bunch of people that are competing for you know, likes and the few dollars that they might earn. And two, nobody there understands what you're trying to accomplish. Right. You know, they how can they say whether this is or isn't a successful photograph? Mm. I mean, you could do one that looks like just like anything that Elliot Erwitt or Steve McCurry or Dorothy Lange created, and people would go, oh, it was amazing. That wins a Pixotto. Okay, but is it good art? Is it, and more importantly, is it your art?
Yeah, yeah.
It may look very much like Steve McCurry's Afghan Girl. It might be better than Steve McCurry's Afghan Girl, but is that the point of art? I mean, I have a chapter called Winning at Yoga. I mean, it's the same thing. Yeah. This competitive stuff is such a waste of our creative energy. Yeah. When we start looking around at everyone else and comparing ourselves, that we are looking in exactly the wrong direction. We're not looking at our art and at ourselves. Mm. Forget how good your stuff. I mean, did Picasso ever wonder how good his stuff was next to, I don't know, Monet or someone that had painted 100 years before him? Or but it certainly didn't get in the way of him creating the thing that he created. You know, if everyone else had kind of weighed in and not liked Picasso's cubist stuff, would he have continued in that vein, or would he just kind of, not everyone in my Facebook group likes this, and I should probably go back to painting flowers and faces that look like human beings. and we would have missed out on Guernica and all of these things that Picasso gave us in terms of an ability to see things in a new way. Yeah. So I don't know. We're all prone to it. Of course, we're all tempted by it. But I think we need to be intentional about it and say, I will not listen to this voice because it's not doing me any good. We could all reclaim that time we spend on Facebooks. God knows we'd be better doing our art than talking about it. Mm. You know,
absolutely. Well, you know what? I realize it's your Sunday evening, and we've gone way over an hour, so I think we should probably start to wrap it up at this point.
For the sake of the listeners, oh God, are they almost done yet?
No, you know what? I know that the listeners are going to enjoy this as much as I have, and I could sit here for the rest of the morning. So, but we'll start to wrap it up. From me at least, you know that I feel as though anyone and everyone that has an interest in not only leading a creative life, but a good life, anyone. This book, and I'm not doing the blowing smoke thing again, really, from the bottom of my heart, I mean this absolutely sincerely, that I believe that this book is world-changing, and it's probably going to be one of the most important photography, creative, and even, like, living your life, a better life, genre books of probably at least of the decade, if not larger. I think it really has. It was a pleasure to read. You know that. I mean, I'm not a fast reader. I enjoy reading, but I didn't read much as a kid, and as a result, I'm actually a really slow reader. And when I'd said that I would send you some comments on the book, and I read it. I actually put 3 days aside to read it because I know that I'm such a slow reader. And I started after breakfast one morning, and I finished in the middle of the evening. It took me a full day, but I literally couldn't put it down. It was one of those books that you've got to know what's on the next page, and it propels you through the book. I just think it's such a great piece of literature.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And actually, it's given me an idea for marketing it, because, you know, it's like, read this book, get two days of your life for free.
Well, I did. I gained 2 days of my life last week, and I was able to go off and do something creative with that as well. But
just the fine print, of course, is that you can't apply it at the back end of your life. It's not cumulative.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And as always, it's been really, it's been wonderful to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much for your time, David. And people will, obviously, if you listen to this, we'll have links to go over and buy the book on, I'll put this in a blog post. If you go to mbp.ac/424, you'll be able to go jump over and grab your copy. But it's right there on Craft and Vision as well.
It is. And you know, if the book kind of sparks things, Martin, I've also started a website, abeautifulanarchy.com.
Oh, excellent.
And my hope on that is that it will become sort of a place. As you know, a lot of the stuff I write on my own photography blog blog these days is, you know, much more about life and about this creative stuff than it is about photography specifically.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping that this will become a hub, and actually it's already populated with something like, you know, 20 articles and desktop wallpapers and that sort of thing.
Excellent.
That's is all new content for people that yes, they are photographers, but they also see themselves in sort of a bigger context of being a creative person. And so there will be conversations about how we create and even the sort of the solopreneur kind of stuff about people that are creating their living as well as their life.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
So you obviously, I mean, it's not a photography book as such. It's not filled of beautiful pictures. It's a paperback. So people can also get it on Kindle as well as the PDF, I believe.
Yeah, they can. So there's a paperback that we sort of decided that, you know, one of the things about traditional publishing is that they want to make their money everywhere they can. And so if you go to Within the Frame online and you buy a paper book, you will be charged equally, if not more, for the same PDF. Mm-hmm. We have not done that. We have said if you buy a paperback, we will give you a free PDF, which is good because the post office takes time, and this way you can start reading it. Mm-hmm. So on craftandvision.com or on beautifulanarchy.com, you can buy the paperback and the PDF with worldwide shipping included for $30. And the PDF will be sort of, you'll get a download link immediately and can start reading. Or you can buy the PDF alone for $10. Or if you're a Kindle type, you can go to the Kindle store at amazon.com or amazon.whatever, and on there you can download A Beautiful Anarchy for your Kindle.
Wow.
Also, so, for something ridiculous like $9.99 or $9.07, depending on where you live. I don't know.
Yeah. So for $9 point something, you can change your life. go and do that, folks. It's one of those life-changing books. So, and I'm
Thank
not
you,
just
buddy.
Saying that because David's a friend. It really is.
It's kind of you.
So really, thanks a lot, David. It's been a pleasure.
Yep. My pleasure.
And we'll...
Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, hopefully before too long.
Perfect.
Thanks a lot.
Wow. It's always a pleasure to speak with David, and that was probably one of the best conversations we've had so far. So I really, really hope that you're going to enjoy that. I'm sure you will. And I'm sure you'll enjoy A Beautiful Anarchy as well. Before we finish, I'd like to just quickly mention that following the success of the in-studio Pixels to Pigment workshop that we did right here in my Tokyo studio in May this year, we have set up another date. The next Pixels to Pigment in-studio is going to be August 23-24 this year. So if you're interested, come over to the... I'll put links in the blog posts, but go directly to the P2P page. Is mbp.ac/p2p, P number 2p. And also, we have just one space left on this year's Iceland tour from September 22 to October 3. So if you're interested in coming with us, there's one chance left. So go over to mbp.ac/Iceland2014 to see some details of what we'll be getting up to and to book your place if you're interested. So thanks very much for listening today. Remember that you can find me on Google+, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode. But in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.